Context from the Couch, a teaching platform where we want to look at the Bible in its original context. I'm Kelly Couch, co-host along with Aaron Couch. Our hope is that this teaching will inspire you to look deeper into God's Word and ultimately walk deeper with Him in your daily life.
All right, welcome to episode 2.
Hey guys.
We are going to cover some background work today. Before we ever get into the Gospels, I think it's important for us to understand a little bit about the Gospels themselves, and then kind of a timeline of where the world is at as far as the world that Jesus lives in and how it got there. And so we're going to talk about some of these things. And first, I want to begin with talking about the Gospels themselves. One of the things that we mentioned last session is the Gospels were not written to be harmonized. It's not like these guys got in a room and decided to, they're not trying to validate each other's story even. What they're doing is each one of them has an audience and an agenda, and each one of them is from a place, and both of those things influence why they say what they say, and more importantly, why they don't say what they don't say.
Right.
For example, John the Apostle spends way more time on John the Baptist than any of the other Gospels. And the question is why? Well, John's writing in Asia Minor towards the end of the first century. And John the Baptist was a really big deal there long before the Jesus movement ever showed up. When Paul goes to Ephesus in his missionary journey, he runs into disciples of John. And so John is really, his message has really extended way past where the Jesus movement has gone, long before Jesus people ever get there. And so John takes the time to say, here's where John the Baptist fits in the narrative of Jesus as Messiah, because these people are very familiar with that. So this is one example of how they're influenced in what they write. We're going to work through the Gospels and just pick out some kind of highlight points to make sure that we understand about each Gospel, and then we'll move into our timeline.
Yeah, so Matthew, if we start with Matthew, Matthew was written to Jews. So it was for Jews, to Jews, and he's going to state concepts and words and ideas and a lot of the Old Testament. And he's going to assume that his readers know this. Of course, as we read it, we are not Jewish, and so we won't know that context immediately, which means we'll have to do a little bit of work to figure some of that out. It's also written in Hebrew. Again, it was for the Jews. The purpose of it was to confirm the gospel for persecuted Jewish Christians. There's quotes or alluding to the Old Testament 65 times.
Which makes sense.
Right.
That they would do that.
Right.
Yep.
Because the Torah or the Old Testament, that's their Bible. That's their scripture. That's their text. It describes Jesus as King and Messiah. And the human theme of it is righteousness. You want to say anything about that?
What that means is that the Jews had such an emphasis on following the rules. Matthew comes in and says, Jesus wasn't in violation of the rules like some of you thought he was. He was calling us back to the spirit of the law instead of the letter of the law. Like, for example, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And so he talks a lot about what does righteousness actually look like? Not so much like this call to you better shape up and live right, but what does it actually look like?
Right. Okay. It's also the most didactic. Tell us what that means.
It means it's teaching heavy. The entire Sermon on the Mount is in the Gospel of Matthew, right? It's the one that contains the most of Jesus's teaching, where Luke has all these stories, way more stories than any of the other Gospels, the parables. Matthew focuses on the teaching.
Okay. And then the last thing we want to cover before we move on to another Gospel is, this is the Gospel of the Church. You want to expound on that?
Yeah, it's the gospel of what is the church supposed to look like? Where did it get its start? What does community look like? And how do we function in it well?
Nice. Also, I should say that Matthew was written around AD 45. So Mark was written around AD 65. And this is the gospel of action. And the audience for this were the Roman believers. And so, of course, they're not going to know certain Jewish ideas or concepts or context. And so Mark is going to go into way more explanation of things than the book of Matthew would.
Mm-hmm. Explains a lot of the customs around Jewish life.
Mark's going to base all of his writings from Peter's preachings. And this is also called the Gospel of Deeds.
Yeah. It's all about action. Jesus is seen as the continuous worker. He's always doing. He's moving from one thing to the next.
Euthys. It's Greek for immediately. It's used 41 times.
Yeah. It's the book of action.
Yeah. This is
immediately they did this. And then right now they did this. And then they went over here real fast.
Got it. It's interesting that there's nothing about Jesus' birth or childhood in Mark.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because the Romans aren't interested in unimportant details.
All right.
They want, like, who is this guy? What's he been up to? Why do you call him God? Why do you call him Lord and God when we call Caesar Lord and God?
Got it. Okay. Mark's also the shortest gospel, and it's probably the most chronological. There's two alternate endings.
Yeah. So there's a source text of where we get, like, can we trust what we have today says the same thing as it did when it was originally written. Our two best source texts disagree on how Mark ends. And so one has it ending in the middle of chapter 16, what we understand is chapter 16, one has it extended. And there's a lot in that second half of chapter 16. So we'll look at that way down the road when we get there. But there's questions about where it actually ends.
Mm-hmm. Of course, because this is a Roman audience and not Jewish, it's going to explain a lot of the customs. It contains Latinisms because the Romans spoke Latin. And so just like we have Americanisms, they have Latinisms. And so there's going to be a lot of that in this book. We have the messianic secret of don't tell anyone in this book.
Yeah. So the reason why that matters is because one of the things that Romans are wrestling with is Rome is this massive empire with a Lord and God and a gospel and a savior of the world and all of that. If Jesus is that and more, like you're trying to say he is, why haven't we heard of him?
Mm-hmm.
Why he's in this corner of the empire that's like so irrelevant to the grand empire. Why haven't we heard of him? Well, here's why. Because he said, don't tell anybody.
Mm-hmm. All right, Luke was written possibly a few years before Mark in AD 60. And we call this the gospel of humanity. Why is that?
This is a gospel that focuses on the human interaction with Jesus and on Jesus's humanity in himself. And what we mean by that is Jesus came to show us what God's like. There's no question about that. But he also came to show us what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm.
And so Luke, being a non-Jew and the only non-Jew to write a gospel, this is really important to him to see the humanity of Jesus, the kind of the universal connection of all people, all places, all times.
Yeah. So Luke is going to write to this Theophilus person. It could be a person.
Mm-hmm.
And it means lover of God. Is
mm-hmm.
that right? So it could be a person named Theophilus, and it could be a group of people who love God,
yep.
who he's just naming Theophilus.
Mm-hmm.
But it's for the Gentiles. This book is for the Gentiles, from a Gentile to Gentiles.
Yep, specifically to the region of Asia Minor.
Mm-hmm. Luke's also the longest of the Gospels. It's 80 verses more than Matthew. Wow. It has the most comprehensive range.
Yeah, it covers the broadest diverse group of topics
okay.
of all the gospels individually. So the other gospels cover these topics, but Luke has more of them contained in a broader section in one book.
All right. There's strong emphases on prayer, on the Holy Spirit, on joy, praise, and thanksgiving, and then on Christ's humanity.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the most literary of all the books because Luke is very educated. He's a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the most, what would you say, well-written?
Yeah, it's the most like written like somebody who knew how to write.
Got it. Luke also contains the most parables. There's 23 parables. And it has a long, quote-unquote, exclusive section. What's that?
That means he has a huge section, chapter 9, verse 51, all the way to chapter 18, verse 14. None of the other gospels have that.
Mm.
It's his own chunk.
Hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then John. Good old John. It's written quite a bit later than all the rest of them. We're looking at maybe 80, 85 to 90. And this is the theological gospel.
Yeah, it really focuses on the character of God, the nature of God.
Okay. This is the last gospel that's written. There aren't any parables at all in this. It's an emphasis on the deity of Christ.
Yeah. So where Luke stresses his humanity, John stresses his deity.
Okay.
And I think there's a contextual reason for that. John's writing from Ephesus to Asia Minor in this world of there being a conglomeration of gods. And John is like, Jesus needs to stand out among these gods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I think he's writing it from that perspective.
Right. There's seven major I ams. Why is that a big deal?
Yeah. So the seven great I am statements, I am the bread of life. I am the resurrection and the life. I am living water. What all these different seven major I ams, these are all contained in the book of John. And what John is doing with them that's fascinating is using them as a direct attack on seven of the chief gods of the Roman pantheon. And that's important because they're Asclepius. I'm the resurrection and life. No. Jesus says the resurrection and the life. Mm-hmm. He claimed it. And so now the question is, well, did Jesus actually make those statements? Yes. John is using them for a larger purpose other than just recording historical events.
Okay. There's also 27 personal interviews with Jesus, probably because John was in his inner circle.
Yep.
He knew lots of stuff about Jesus.
Yep.
He was the only one to record the early Judean ministry.
Yeah, John's frustrating in this regard. If we don't have John, we can put the timeline of everything that happened in the first three Gospels into 18 months. John's the one that pushes it out to 3.5 years.
Interesting. The great recurring themes are life, love, light, and truth.
And that's important because what you have to keep thinking about is John was the sons of thunder. John was the one that was like, let's call down fire on the Samaritans. That's John. And all of a sudden, John's writing at the end of his life about love and light and, you know, all these things that are, and 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, same thing, right? 1st John's known as the love book. Like, what in the world happened to him?
It's like being around Jesus changed him or something.
Yeah, for sure.
Crazy. There's a lack of movement in this book.
Yeah, it's painfully slow.
Versus Mark, which is the Batman Marvel comic.
Right, pow, zam.
Right. One third of the gospel covers one day.
Yeah. Yep.
Painfully slow. Okay. There's an announced purpose.
Yeah, so this book is unique in the gospels in that in chapter 20, verse 30, he says, if we wrote down everything that Jesus did, the world couldn't contain the volumes. But these things are written so that you can believe that Jesus is the Christ. Okay. Like it's specifically, here's why I did this, so that you can know who Jesus is.
Okay. And then lastly, this book, it helps to date the length of Jesus's ministry, which we kind of just covered.
Yep. So each of the gospels is unique in that they have a different reason why they're even being written in the first place. And so we say all that to underscore, it's hard to harmonize these at times. And what we're going to do is we're going to try to walk the line as best as we can of getting into that conversation well. But we also wanted to look at it and go, can we, if we do the work of harmonizing everything, can we learn some things in the trajectory of Jesus's life that is valuable? And I would offer, yes, yes, we can. So what we want to do right now is I want to walk through a timeline. And this timeline is going to go way back further than you think it should. But all of these points in time heavily influence what's happening in the first century in Jesus' day. And we go back all the way to, if you think about, you have the period of the judges. And in the period of the judges, you have this cycle. Some people call it the sin cycle. I would call it the redemption cycle because God is the point of the narrative, not me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is important. This is just what I believe is a truism of the Bible. God's story is driving the narrative, not my sin.
Right.
That truth really helps us. For example, when we talk about Jesus on the cross, I would offer that your sin doesn't put Jesus on the cross. His love for you does. And that's an important distinction because we get so caught up in the shame of letting our sin drive the story. And Jesus isn't interested in that.
Right.
He's like, no. Here's the story. And it goes all the way back to Genesis 1.
Right.
In the beginning, God created. And just that one statement is revolutionary because up until that time, all the other creation stories of cultures believed that the gods birthed the earth out of conflict. Mm. So now, this for the first time ever, there's a God that shows up and says, I wasn't mad. I love you. And it's good. Mm-hmm. And things are wonderful. Sin gets in the way. But the invitation of the scriptures is to go back to what sin broke. To restore naked and unashamed. That which isn't really about clothes. It's about when we stand together with one another, we have no other agenda.
Right. And yet, how much of our Christianity or how much theology have we been taught where basically our story starts in Genesis 3?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where it starts.
Yeah, with the fall.
Right.
And taught things like you made Jesus sad when you did that. Mm-hmm. You can't make Jesus sad.
Why?
Because there's nothing that you're going to do that he doesn't know you already did.
Right.
Right? Like you can't disappoint God, which I hang with that.
Right.
You can't disappoint God because there's nothing that you're going to do. Disappointment is always rooted in unmet expectations. There's nothing that you're going to do where God's going to go, oh, wow, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
There's just doesn't exist.
Right.
And so I think that we get caught up in making our choices way too important in God's narrative.
Yeah.
And I think what the scripture's trying to teach us is that no, God is sovereign. God's the one driving the story. Trust him. He has good plans for you.
Yeah, this actually makes me think about that story of that Moshe shares in his shop. So Moshe is a friend of ours who's a Canadian Jewish shop owner in Old Town Israel, Jerusalem, excuse me. He has this ministry. He really wants to be a bridge between Judaism and Christianity because we worship the same God. When he knows Christian groups are coming in, he'll shut down the shop so shoppers can't get in. And he'll throw out chairs and basically he just shares a little from his heart about Jewish perspective. He goes, you know, Jews don't understand Christians and Christians don't understand Jews, but like somebody's got to have a conversation. And so he just provides this safe space where Christians can ask him literally anything they want and he's not going to get offended.
Yeah.
And he'll answer them. And so I remember him saying, you know, one big difference between Judaism and Christianity is that Christians think about their sin 364 days of the year, and then there's one day where they don't, which is Easter. And he goes, Judaism is the complete opposite. 364 days of the year, we don't think about our sin. We think about how much God delights in us because we're his kids. Mm. And one day of the year, the Day of Atonement, they think about their sin. And I wonder where along the way we Jesus followers diverted and started thinking so much about sin, right? Because you're saying that God's love drives the story, which
yes.
Moshe is saying that's exactly how they live their lives.
Mm-hmm.
God's love drives the story, how much he delights in them.
Yep. Yep. All that rabbit trail is all to get back to the judges. It's important for us to understand God's not up in heaven going, oh my gosh, they're at it again. What am I going to do? No, God's driving the narrative. And so we want to know that it's a redemption cycle. But it seems as if in that cycle, like the Jews can't hold it together morally. Like they fall apart. They become corrupt. They fall into sinful lifestyle very, very quickly. And so this happens again and again and again, all the way to the point where they choose a king. So then they have Saul, then David, then Solomon. And then because of Solomon's choices, the kingdom gets divided. And you have the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. So the northern kingdom is Israel. Southern kingdom is Judah. What begins to happen is they start having a few good kings, but mostly bad kings, both of them. Judah has more good kings than Israel does, but still not a great batting average. What happens is in 720, 721 BC, Assyria comes in and conquers the northern kingdom. And the way that Assyria ruled was they would take a people group and break them up and send them all out over the world. They kind of denationalized a country. So they would put, as they conquered a nation, they would repopulate all these other nations that they had conquered with a percentage of their people, and specifically the leaders of that country that they just conquered. So they send some to Asia Minor. They send, we see in Obadiah that there's Jews in Sardis that were sent there because of the what's known as the diaspora, the scattered Jews. And the hope is that by intermingling with all of these other nations, that they will ultimately wind up kind of losing their identity entirely. So now they don't have anything to fight for, because if there's going to be a revolt, one of the biggest reasons for revolt is to step into reclaiming our identity before our God. And that's something that Assyria tried to do with that. Now, they would tax the heck out of you, but they didn't really care too much about keeping people together. They disbanded countries and all of that stuff. And so this is why we have Jews scattered all over. The interesting thing about that is the Jews are called fundamentally as a people to remain distinct. So wherever they went, they really never intermingled at any serious level. So they never lost their identity. And that becomes one of the things that allows them to ultimately come back and repopulate Israel, which fascinating. So Syria comes in, conquers the northern kingdom. Things continue to not go well. 586-ish BC, Babylon comes in and finally puts the final nail in the coffin. There's actually three deportations of Babylon. But Babylon comes in and really conquers the rest of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Babylon's ruling style was very different than Assyria. Assyria was like, hey, we want you to succeed because we tax you and that makes us rich. Babylon was like, what we're going to do is we're going to beat you up. We're going to kick your dog. We're going to burn your house down. Like that was, they just wanted to just dominate people. And they hauled the Jewish people as slaves back to Babylon. And this is critical. Babylon becomes the pivot point for all of these things that happen. One of the things that's interesting, and we don't question it, is like when you start reading the Gospels, if you've been reading through the Old Testament and then you start in the Gospels, you see these things like Pharisees, Sadducees. None of these are mentioned in the Old Testament ever. Like, where did they come from? Mm-hmm. Well, they come from Babylon. A huge amount of the prophetic work of the Old Testament is written during the time of the Babylonian captivity. Not all of it, but a huge amount of it is written during the Babylonian captivity. And that's like, this is a major point, so much so that when Jesus steps on the scene, Jews no longer see themselves as Mosaic Jews. They see themselves as Babylonian Jews. They are dramatically pivoted by this one fundamental question, and that is, why did God lead us into captivity? And their answer to that question was, because we sinned.
Right.
That then led them to this determination to say, we are going to live so righteously that we will never go into captivity again. Right. So what happens then is they wind up starting synagogue, the school, nothing like it has been duplicated since then. It's an incredible way to educate. They invent these offices of Pharisees, these people who are there to protect the law. And so they wind up having all these different, and so when they come back, because Babylon ultimately falls to Persia, and Cyrus the Great releases an edict that says that the Jews could come home. What's fascinating about that is they still had all the original implements from the temple that was destroyed, from Solomon's temple in Babylon. And Cyrus gives them back to the Jews to take with them when they go home. And this is Ezra and Nehemiah, that kind of time frame. Only about 125,000 Jews return home at that point. And the reason is because they have to completely rebuild from the ground up. Like, this is not easy living. So they could stay in Babylon, live comfortably and get taxed, or they could go to Israel, have to live a hard life and get taxed. Like, you pick. I would probably choose easy. This is Esther. This is that time period. So then Greece comes through and conquers the world. And then when Alexander the Great dies, this is the mid-330s BC. When Alexander the Great dies, his empire gets divided ultimately amongst four generals. There's a lot more to that story, but this is the important detail. Seleucus kind of gets north of Israel and the Mesopotamian area. Ptolemy gets Egypt and Israel. And Israel is this really critical piece of land on the trade routes because you have to pass through Israel. So whoever controls that tiny little piece of real estate can get really wealthy by taxing the trade route. Seleucus and Ptolemy immediately go to war. They start battling over Israel. And the problem is those Jews that had returned home, they kind of get caught in the crossfire. and they are brutally tortured. There's all kinds of stories of what happened. They would string guys up, tie their hands above their head and pull them tight, and then carve 1-inch squares in their back with a knife, and then peel their skin 1 inch at a time. Like it was horrible what they would do to them. And so the way that Alexander ruled was he invited the world to become Greece. He was like, I'm going to build cities that are all the best of what Greece has to offer, and people are going to love us for it. He was 100% right. Mm-hmm. And fact of the matter is we are Greek to our core,
right,
because of Alexander the Great. To this day, where Alexander invited the world to become Greece, Ptolemy and Seleucus demanded it. And now remember, these Jews went to Babylon, they believed, because they had sinned.
Right.
They returned determined to live righteous,
right,
and they're being invited to indulge the flesh. And this causes a battle, an internal conflict for the Jewish people that is tough for them to be in. That ultimately winds up leading to what's known as the Maccabean Revolt. It's written about in the apocryphal works, the First and Second Maccabees. Judah, the Maccabee, Maccabee wasn't his last name. Maccabee is the Hebrew word for hammer. Judah the Hammer is what they call him, which is either a really good description of his personality or it's his UFC fighting name. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which one. But he leads a revolt, and it's a cool story.
We get Hanukkah out of this, right?
We get Hanukkah out of this, but it's this really awesome story. He leads this revolt that ushers in what's known as the Hasmonean dynasty. And 150 BC, in the words of Braveheart, they have a country of their own for the first time.
Yeah.
Since 721 BC, they have a country of their own. And at that point, like 250,000 Jewish people return from Babylon, and it's the only time in history that this has ever happened, where a group of people is conquered out of a land, and then they wind up repopulating the land later on. And so they build in. Now, what's interesting is they are determined to live righteous. They're determined to do it. They're bringing all of these things back from Babylon with them, synagogue and Pharisees and all of these things. And then they wind up the fifth generation from Judah, fifth king after Judah. His name is Alexander, fifth Hasmonean king. Why is that a big deal? Well, that's not a very Jewish name.
Mm-hmm.
And what wound up happening is the very thing that they revolted against, they became. And so now here we are. Now, they wouldn't say that because they were living righteously. They were following the rules. They had rebuilt a very small version of the temple. Ultimately, when Herod comes in, which we'll talk about in just a second, when Herod comes in, they wind up really building it up. They're living by the rules, living by the rules. We will live righteously. And then Rome comes through. In 63 BC, they fall under Roman occupation. So now they're wrestling with a different question. As they're leading into their revolt, and then they have the revolt, but then they fall back under Roman occupation. The question that they're wrestling with now isn't why did we go into captivity? It's why do the righteous suffer? We are people who are living righteously. Now there would be a ton of debate about whether that's actually true, mm-hmm, but they believed it was true. And so now they're wrestling with this, why do the righteous suffer? And it's in this kind of intertestamental period that the conversation around reward in the afterlife really kind of emerges to the front. If you read the Old Testament, you're hard pressed to find any reference to people going to heaven. Because for them and for the people who Jesus is teaching to, the action is here and the goal is to live here well, which to go back to Moshe, one of the things that he says, you Christians are so fascinated with the afterlife. You're like, you want to get to heaven and get to heaven, get to heaven. He goes, as a Jew, I don't really think about heaven much. What I think about is, am I cleaved to the Lord with all of my heart, with all of my soul, and with all my strength right now in this moment? If I am, then whatever happens after I die will take care of itself. If I'm not, then I need to be.
So good.
Which like, it's a way better way to look at it. You know, we're so scared about missing heaven. And he's like, don't worry about heaven. Worry about this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Just be present, which feels very Jesus-y to me.
Yeah.
Don't worry about tomorrow. Today has enough trouble of its own. Jesus says things like that often. So when Rome comes in and conquers this area, they give the governing of this area to a Nabataean guy by the name of Antipater. And Antipater is by far the most famous of the Nabataeans, and they're a cool people, kind of the runners of the trade routes, super wealthy, crazy, ridiculous stuff that they do. Archaeologists still just shake their heads at some of the stuff that the Nabataeans pulled off. Oh. Antipater has two sons, one whose name is Phazael and the other whose name is Herod. Herod gets this section called Israel, and he comes in as the king of this area. And the Jews are not having it because the Nabataeans are connected to the Edomites, which the reason why that matters is because they're descendants of Esau. And that truth is not lost on the Jews, that a descendant of Esau is trying to rule over the descendants of Jacob. Mm-hmm. So he marries Miriam, who's a Hasmonean queen, to legitimize, quote unquote, his reign. And winds up being a pretty decent king in a lot of respects. He's maniacal and paranoid, but he's also a prolific builder and figures out, you know, Caesarea Maritima, where he builds a deep seaport where there was no deep water, figured out how to get concrete to harden 150 feet underwater. Like, it just, he did some really incredible things building the Temple Mount. Like, the size of the stones that they quarried and put them there. We'll talk more about all that later on, but just incredible stuff that he did. And so he's ruling, and he, on one hand, is very generous, very pays really well. Also, he's really brutal anytime that there's any kind of a revolt or riot or disagreement. He's really brutal, and he has the entire weight of the Roman army behind him, so he really does some awful things, and there's a number of stories around that. So as we enter into this where Jesus shows up, the reason why all of this matters is because all of these things are heavily influencing the narrative of what's going on around the people that Jesus is trying to teach. They are a people who are war-torn. They've seen very little peace in 700 years. And that's a big deal. Like, that takes its toll on the identity of a people over time. I remember when we were in Jerusalem, the first time we ever went to Israel, we went to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum, and there was some Hasidic Jews in there. And we asked them, when you guys walk through this, how does this make you feel? Young guys. And they said, it's just one more story in a story of our people of battles and torture and being beat on. Like, that's really, it's part of the ethos of who they are. It's so deeply ingrained. And that's important, because what's happening when Jesus shows up is everybody's wrestling with this question, what do we do with Rome? How do we handle Rome? And so they're really crying out for a Messiah. Now, what we often think in our world is what they wanted in Messiah was a military leader, a warrior king, the son of David. It's not really what they were after. What they were after was a righteous judge, somebody who would vindicate the righteous. That's what they were looking for. They wanted to be liberated, but because of their righteousness, not so that Rome could pay. It wasn't that. It was more about vindicating the righteous. And what Jesus keeps saying, this is one of the reasons why Matthew emphasizes righteousness. What Jesus keeps saying is, you're missing it. You're not the righteous people that you think you are. It's not the rules that make you righteous. It's your heart before God. And so that really becomes a revolutionary piece. Now, just a few minutes here, and then we'll call it an episode. There's four groups of people that you need to pay attention to that Jesus is constantly interacting with. These are important. The first group is the Pharisees. They kind of live in the Galilee for the most part. This is where Jesus was born. I think if you were going to try to label Jesus as any one of these four groups, it would have to be a Pharisee. The Pharisees' perspective on Rome was, don't care about Rome, just keep the rules. That was how they chose to deal with Rome. Rome is Rome. Whatever they're going to do, they're going to do. We just need to focus and keep the rules. That's it. The second group is the Sadducees. And the Sadducees, they are part of the temple. And what's interesting about the Sadducees is they don't believe in an afterlife. Now, if you control the God of this people and all the power that comes in a theocratic society, you control the temple, you control the God, and you don't believe in an afterlife. So only thing that there is what's going on here and now. What does that lead to? Like, massive corruption, massive. And they are taking advantage, because it's just about, like, all I get is this life. So I'm just going to milk this life for everything I can.
Right.
And that's why Jesus has some of his harshest rebukes for the Sadducees. If you think about this, Jesus spends 3.5 years with the Pharisees. They don't know what to do with him, but they engage him in conversation. He spends 1 week with the Sadducees and they kill him.
Yeah.
Like that is pretty serious business.
Yeah.
Then there's the Zealots. Now the Zealots, they believed that God ushers in the kingdom by force. And that's why they become so violent. And we'll talk lots about that along the way. But their way of dealing with Rome is we're going to overthrow them by military power. We're going to usher in the kingdom of God.
Right.
The last group is the Essenes. Now the Essenes, there's so much debate about the Essenes. Most of scholarship would still agree that they are a group of people who branched off of the temple. They said that the temple was apostate, it was corrupt, and they were Sadducees, so they were very wealthy, and they left it all and sold all of their possessions and moved out into the desert to live separately. And that was the way that they dealt with Rome, separate and isolate ourselves. And what I find fascinating about these four groups of people is that, first of all, Jesus really tries to commend what they have right. Like, none of them have a complete picture, but none of them have it completely wrong either. And that's an important thing to wrestle with. There's, I think, one of the mistakes that we make in humanity is we try to make somebody all good or all bad.
Yep.
And I would offer that maybe that's not a good way to look at people. They had some things that were right, that were good, and they had some things that were a train wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, Jesus does these, he has these conversations. But what's important is if they could have found a way to come together and really lean in on what do we agree with and how can we work together in this process rather than going, no, I'm just going to get around a group of people who agree with me.
Sounds like denominations.
Yeah, it does. It does. Then I believe they could have had a completely different outcome, but they didn't.
Right.
And so here we sit in this space with these four groups of people, and Jesus is going to be constantly negotiating how to interact with them. Now, that being said, what you need to know is often what Jesus says, and more importantly, how he says what he says, is directly connected to the group of people that he's talking to. And so that's important for us to know. We don't often think about that. We just think Jesus' teaching is all empirically true regardless of situation. And what I would offer is, no, it's specifically true based on the context that he's applying it to. And that's important. So these are the four groups of people that Jesus is trying to navigate. And he's trying to train his disciples to be able to get there well. And eventually they do it, which is the incredible thing.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually they do it. So that's our background work on all of this stuff. We'll come back in and start jumping into the riveting conversation on genealogy. Believe me, there's a lot more going on there than you think.
Yeah.
There always is. One of my favorite sermons I ever heard was on a genealogy. And the title of the sermon was "Don't Call It a List." It's so much more than a list. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to take a look at that and maybe some of the layers that we can pull out of that piece. But that'll be our next session. So until next time, we'll be back soon.
Thanks for tuning in, guys.